Unintended consequences today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Tariffs on Chinese-made goods are having an impact on hotels here in the U.S. They buy a lot of furniture that's made in China. And if tariffs go higher, U.S. hotels may look to buy those products elsewhere.
Like most of the case goods now are going to be coming out of Vietnam. And bath vanities, a lot of that product's going to be coming out of India.
In other words, not from China, but not from the U.S. either. Also, the layoffs GM announced this week are a symptom of big changes in the auto industry. How big?
As large as any since the internal combustion engine became the dominant design for automobiles.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We are glad you could be here today. Donald Trump's relationship with Russia prior to his election, it's the question that's dogged his presidency from day one. We know what Trump himself has said.
I know nothing about Russia. I know about Russia, but I know nothing about the inner workings of Russia. I don't deal there. I have no businesses there. I have no loans from Russia.
I have no dealings with Russia. I have no deals in Russia. I have no deals that could happen in Russia because we've stayed away. And I have no loans with Russia.
But what has the investigation of Special Counsel Robert Mueller found? We may have gotten a little closer to an answer today when Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's longtime attorney, entered a guilty plea in a court in New York. Cohen admitted to lying to Congress about a proposed deal to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. He now says his talks with Trump about the project went on for far longer than he originally admitted, right through June 2016, when Trump was already the presumptive Republican nominee for president. Cohen says he briefed members of Trump's family about the deal as well. Today, standing near the presidential helicopter, Trump called Cohen a liar.
He's a weak person, and what he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence. So he's lying about a project that everybody knew about. I mean, we were very open with him.
Asha Rangappa is a former FBI special agent. I asked her where Trump and Cohen's accounts clashed when it comes to the proposed Moscow Trump Tower deal.
What Michael Cohen testified to Congress was that the deal basically fell apart in January of 2016, and that would have been the very early part of Trump's campaign, before the primaries, before he had become a candidate. And what Michael Cohen is now saying is that these discussions actually continued throughout the campaign and the primaries and into June of 2016, almost up to when he went to the Republican National Convention. And the reason that this is important is because Trump had such a favorable view towards Russia, because at the Republican National Convention, the platform on Ukraine was changed. During this whole time, what wasn't known to the American public was that Trump was actually negotiating a deal in which he had a personal financial interest. And that is really relevant in terms of his motivations, potential foreign influence, and of course, after that, also potential leverage that Russia had over him.
So just remind us what we know about the details of the proposed Moscow Trump Tower project. What exactly was under discussion?
Well, if you look at the information that Mueller has filed, Cohen was basically in contact with Felix Sater, who in turn was in contact with very high levels of the Russian government, including aides and assistants to Vladimir Putin, to arrange not only for this project, but for President Trump to potentially go to Russia to meet with President Putin, which is obviously really significant. The information also reveals that Cohen was, during this time, in frequent contact with Donald Trump about this. So this isn't something that Michael Cohen was doing on the side under his own authority or something like that. This is something that he was consulting with the president. And basically, he lied about all of this in his testimony to Congress.
So the proposed tower deal in Moscow never transpired. But from what we know, would it be accurate to call the proposed deal for this tower something of a sweetheart deal?
That is how it's been described by the people that have gone into the details of the project itself. You know, basically, this is something that Trump would have stood to profit from significantly. And as you can imagine, when someone is running as a candidate for a position of public trust, to say the least, for the president of the United States as the highest fiduciary duty in the country. You know, this is the kind of thing that should be disclosed and should be known. We've always had questions about why he has been so timid towards Putin and with regard to things Putin has done in other countries and even our own election interference. And so I think that the lack of disclosure there is really troubling.
Trump, as we know, submitted written answers last week to questions Robert Mueller posed to him. And most likely some of those questions dealt with the Trump Tower Moscow deal. It would seem that a lot rides now on what the president said in those answers he submitted to Mueller. What do you think could be the kind of evidence Mueller might rely on to try to prove Cohen is telling the truth, that Cohen is the credible one and the president is committing perjury?
Well, it's important to remember that in filing this information, Mueller isn't just saying this is what Cohen told me. I mean, the information itself references actual emails that substantiate what Cohen has said. And Mueller's going to make sure that he has a corroboration and substantiation because Cohen, of course, is pleading guilty to many crimes. And, you know, his testimony on its own is not going to be credible enough. And for Trump, this is going to be a problem because, as you mentioned, he's turned in his answers to Mueller. And Mueller undoubtedly asked about the Trump Tower Moscow deal. And if Trump stuck with the story that Cohen originally told Congress, that this negotiations ended when they did, he's locked in and could be on the hook for making false statements to Robert Mueller.
Asha Rangappa, a former FBI special agent and a senior lecturer at the Yale Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
With questions about that hotel deal swirling about, President Trump headed off to Argentina today to the G20 summit. He'll be sharing the spotlight with Chinese President Xi Jinping, among others. That could be a little awkward given the trade tensions between the U.S. and China. The president has slapped tariffs on $250 billion worth of imports from China, and the White House plans to raise some of those tariffs from 10 to 25% come the new year. That's got a lot of American business people nervous. Some of them are in that industry so close to Trump's heart, hotels. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
When Michael Sumi puts together a hotel room, he's figuring out a lot of puzzle pieces. He's the principal in charge of interior design with the New York architecture firm Stonehill Taylor.
If you tipped a hotel upside down, it would be everything that falls out. Nightstands and headboards and lounge chairs and rugs and wall covering.
And how many of those items are now subject to tariffs?
It's pretty much everything.
So Sumi and his team design chairs and headboards in New York. They do their drawings with furniture specifications.
That says it's made out of oak and it has metal legs and it's going to look this way. And everything's custom made for hotels.
Then he gives those specifications to what's called a procurement consultant, somebody like Gus Sarf, president of GS Associates in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Sarf shops those drawings around to perhaps a dozen manufacturers to see who can build the best table or chair at the lowest price. Most of the manufacturers today are in China.
We do by category. So lighting, pretty much 100% comes from China. For case goods, it's probably 50 to 60%.
Case goods are basically furniture made from wood and metal, dressers, tables, and chests. Again, right now, those pieces from China are being hit with a 10% tax at the U.S. border. So Sarf then goes to someone like Helen Jorgensen with Host Hotels and Resorts and says, those things you wanted from China, they're going to cost you a bit more.
So there was a little bit of scrambling, a little bit of absorbing of the cost from the suppliers, and us as an owner had to absorb some of it also.
Jorgensen says right now tariffs are a hassle and a headache, but they can handle 10%.
But going to the 25%, that's a different story. So we're looking at basically changing total factories, changing materials. Like most of the case goods now are going to be coming out of Vietnam, quite frankly. And bath vanities, a lot of that product's going to be coming out of India.
The work almost certainly isn't shifting to North Carolina or Virginia, though, where a lot of U.S. furniture was built a generation ago.
I don't see how the economics works anytime soon.
David Bergman is CEO of the Butler Specialty Company. They design things like benches, chairs, and consoles in Chicago, but outsource manufacturing to Asia. Bergman says furniture manufacturing doesn't only go where labor is cheap. It goes where the raw materials, factories, complex machinery, and skilled labor is located. That's mostly gone from the U.S.
My feeling is that it would be virtually impossible or extremely difficult, taking possibly decades, to be able to replicate that with manufacturers in the United States.
So if one of the goals of President Trump's tariffs on China is to shift manufacturing back to the United States, well, it's really hard to find somebody in the hotel, furniture, or hospitality industry who says that's going to happen. But what about Trump hotels? I reached out to the company for comment, but they didn't respond to interview requests. So do people in the hotel industry feel like Trump has turned his back on his own?
Yes, there's a lot of talk about that. I've worked with Trump.
Again, procurement consultant Gus Sarf.
I think he's doing a complete disservice to the country and the industry for how he's approached this. We do feel that you know, China has taken advantage of a lot of things, but there's a different way to go about the process without, you know, upsetting entire industry, and obviously not just ours. This affects a really broad market of manufacturing and imports.
And here's interior designer Michael Sumi.
Trump Hotel Group is dealing with this issue just like everybody else in the United States is. So, you know, it's ironic.
And Sumi isn't just worried about price increases or schedule delays, the short-term headaches caused by tariffs.
We have long-term relationships with a lot of people who make things all over the world. And we've been working with them for years, and there's a trust built up and a level of quality and expectation that's met. And we don't necessarily want to stop working with those manufacturers because they've done a great job.
But if you're buying 5,000 chairs, 10,000 mirrors, and 3,000 beds for a new hotel, and all that could cost you 25% more come January, well, it might be time to go back to the drawing board and start finding new business partners. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
There was an unusual moment of bipartisanship in the U.S. Senate yesterday. Senators from both sides of the aisle came together to support a resolution to get the U.S. out of the war in Yemen by stopping U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia. When the resolution first came to the Senate floor in March, it tanked. But yesterday, a different story.
Let me thank all of the people at the grassroots level throughout our country who helped us today win a major vote on the path toward ending U.S. involvement in the war in Yemen.
Independent Bernie Sanders there celebrating the 63-37 vote. It was a big win because most Republicans normally favor President Trump, the military, and Saudi Arabia.
I changed my mind because I'm f***ed.
That's Republican Lindsey Graham getting mad. Like most of his colleagues, Graham says he wanted to tell Trump and the Saudis that the Senate wants transparency about the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. We wanted to know what some Yemenis think of the vote.
It's great if the United States will stop its weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, because this will save the life of hundreds, if not millions, of Yemenis.
Hussein Abulkadi is a journalist in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. It's a frequent target of Saudi airstrikes. He's a little skeptical about the Senate vote. He calls it a publicity stunt.
The deals that has been struck between the United States and Saudi Arabia during the war in Yemen is the largest deal in U.S. history. We have seen the White House statement about the killing of journalist Khashoggi. It's all about money. We in Yemen make joke about it, that he can milk the Saudi cow more and more and more.
People in other parts of Yemen blame the war not on the Saudis, but the Houthi rebels. And they want the U.S. to stay in the war to help Saudi Arabia get rid of the Houthis. And then there are voices like this from Suha al-Ahmad in southern Yemen.
Maybe it will not stop the war totally, but at least there will be a hope for peace. After years of war, we are tired, we lost a lot, and stopping the military support may open a door for peace.
A hopeful moment yesterday in Washington for Yemen. We've been following the story of the Yemen war since it started, and we'll stay on it. You can read all our Yemen coverage at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Two oversized pickups doing a tug of war in the mud. You know, just burning up gas. Not exactly the direction General Motors was aiming for 10 years ago when it introduced its first consumer hybrid electric car.
Chevy Volt. A car that can go up to 40 miles before it uses any gas at all. That's an American revolution.
Well, it seems GM has put the revolution on hold, at least for now. This week, thousands of GM workers, some of whom make the Volt, found out they may lose their jobs as the company closes five factories in the U.S. and Canada. GM says no single factor drove the decision. It just wants to be ready for the market of the future. But what is that future? John Sturman is an automotive expert and a professor at MIT. What do you make of General Motors' explanation, getting ready for the future? Do you know what that even means?
No, I think they're on the right track. The auto industry is experiencing a massive disruption, as large as any since the internal combustion engine became the dominant design for automobiles in the 19-teens. And I think they're absolutely right to be getting ready for this. They're either going to make that transition or they're going to be a footnote in history.
I mean, the rest of the world is moving away from the internal combustion engine. The UK and France have set target dates to become wholly electric with vehicles, and yet GM doesn't see much of a future for their electric car, the Volt. Can you explain that?
Well, they're switching away from the plug-in electric, the Volt, which has a range extender, meaning a gasoline engine that serves as a generator, to fully electrics, the Bolt. And the Bolt is a pretty terrific car, actually. So I think GM is actually moving in the right direction towards the electric future for light-duty vehicles and cars and trucks in general. They are, and the U.S. industry in general, is behind the rest of the world, and it's largely a function of gasoline prices being far too low in the United States at the pump. Let's be clear, gasoline prices are very high. You just don't pay the full price at the pump, but you pay it in the damage to our health from the pollution, you pay it in the traffic congestion, you pay it in the climate damage that we're already experiencing. So you are paying it, you just don't pay it at the pump. That and weak federal policy, attempted rollbacks on the CAFE standards.
The standards for miles per gallon.
Yeah, it's creating a trap for the U.S. industry, where in the short term, they're responding to consumer preference for large cars, especially SUVs, the prospect of weaker environmental regulations by eliminating sedan production, focusing on higher margin SUVs, and that traps the industry in the production of internal combustion gasoline-powered vehicles for far longer than they as businesses or we as an economy can afford.
I mean, the assumption at GM seems to be that America's love affair with big cars, SUVs, and pickups is going to continue. Where else in the world do these kinds of vehicles dominate the market?
Nowhere else, although, you know, you do see affluent people all over the world buying large vehicles, status-oriented vehicles. It's not news to anyone that the automobile is a major token of your social status and a sign of conspicuous consumption. But it's far worse here in the United States than any other developed economy in the world. So what I would like to see is a shift away from the competition to see who has the biggest, coolest SUV towards who's got the coolest electric vehicle that is quieter, has better performance, and is not damaging the environment. I don't think people are going to stop using their vehicles as tokens of their social status, but let's see if we can get some policies that will align that competition with what's good for our well-being and not harming our future and our health today.
Yeah, and what's weird is that, as you well know, we've seen this show before prior to the Great Recession of 2008. Oil prices went up and the SUV truck calculus failed GM. I mean, the market blunder there led to the near collapse of the auto industry. Why does it make sense now?
Oh, I don't think it makes sense for them to continue to focus on the big SUVs.
Why do you think they think it makes sense?
Well, because those cars have the higher margins, and that's what people want, given the low gasoline prices we have right now.
But what if there's a significant spike in gas prices?
Well, that's entirely possible. They won't be ready in time. They and the other car makers won't be ready in time when consumers start recognizing that they can't afford to keep driving those cars.
By the way, John, how is the trade war with China impacting the auto industry?
Well, it's certainly not great. Higher prices for steel and other materials that go into vehicles clearly raise the cost of production. The threat of retaliation against U.S. car makers who have large and growing markets in China, including GM, has a large growing market in China. These are serious material risks to the company's fortunes and to employment, even in the United States. If GM starts running out of cash, because of retaliation in the trade war, higher prices because of steel tariffs, then that's bad for every worker anywhere in GM's system.
And then there's the advent of driverless cars. It's gotten everyone excited and anxious. How far down the road are they?
Oh, I don't think anybody knows. My personal view is there's going to be systems rolled out. There's already some systems being rolled out, geofenced initially for taxi service. But I think a full-blown, fully autonomous car that can take you anywhere at any time, in any weather, is quite a ways off. And I think there's going to be bumps along the road in terms of court cases around accidents and who's responsible. There's already been serious discussion about what should the programming of the algorithm be so that if the car has to choose between injuring a pedestrian, say, or injuring the occupants of the vehicle, what happens there? And these are serious ethical, legal, and regulatory issues that are going to take a long time to work out, much longer, I think, than it'll take to improve the technology.
So just quickly, where in the world, as you look around, does the transition seem to be working pretty well?
Transitions to electric vehicles? Oh, I think it's happening. It's not happening nearly fast enough, either for the climate or for the health of the auto industry and the workers in it. We've just passed 1 million electric vehicles sold in the United States, and it's growing very fast. But, you know, that compares to 16, 17 million new vehicles in the United States per year. So there's a long way to go, but the U.S. still has the opportunity, if the federal policies were aligned with our long-term interests, to have a major role in the new industry, the new car and transportation and mobility industry that's taking shape. And I think GM understands this. I think they understand they're not going to be a car company in the future. They're going to be a mobility services company in the future, one that may make cars, but will certainly be in the business of providing the access to opportunity through mobility that people actually want.
John Sturman, automotive expert at MIT, thanks very much for explaining this all.
You're very welcome.
Marco Werman. In 2011, this Egyptian demonstrator was part of a crowd that got tear gassed in Cairo. He picked up a canister labeled Made in the USA.
I thought it was called tear gas. I had no idea it was called choke you to death and run around blindly gas.
We visit a Pennsylvania town where tear gas is made. That's still ahead here on The World.
Support for The World comes from Babbel, a European-made language learning program. Babbel teaches practical conversation in Italian, Russian, Swedish, and other languages. Available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And from Clark University's International Development, Community, and Environment Department, where students innovate solutions to global challenges like climate change, hunger, inequity, and injustice, and turn research into action. Learn more at clarku.edu/IDCE.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There will be no private meeting this week between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The one-on-one had been planned as part of the G20 summit in Argentina, but today Trump canceled the meeting, citing tensions surrounding Russia's seizure of three Ukrainian ships in the Black Sea last weekend. Trump and Putin will still both attend the summit of world leaders. Also at the summit, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He arrived in Buenos Aires yesterday to a less than warm welcome. A judge there has opened an investigation into the Crown Prince after Human Rights Watch accused him of war crimes and torture. Natalia Kosoy is a reporter in Buenos Aires. I asked him why the case against bin Salman has been taken up in Argentina.
Well, Human Rights Watch decided Argentina was a good place to try this, as Argentina is a signatory of international agreements allowing for the country to intervene as a member of the world, if you wish, because it agrees to the idea of universal justice, meaning that for very, very serious crimes, a judge here can prosecute someone, never mind whether crimes were committed or who had committed them. And in this case, Human Rights Watch, the human rights organizations, did try that. They just presented their case to a prosecutor in Buenos Aires. The prosecutor analyzed the case and went to this judge and asked the judge to move forward.
So when you talk about this investigation moving forward, I mean, what does the judge need to have or to do to make sure that it continues?
Well, he needs to first decide if he can try or prosecute Bin Salman. And for that, he needs two things. First, he's asking what the status of MBS is here in Buenos Aires, if he's head of state or what is he considered, and that will determine if he is the one who can try him or he has to send the case to the Argentina's Supreme Court. The other thing he needs to learn is if there are similar processes being carried in Saudi Arabia or Yemen against the Crown Prince. And if he can determine there are solid cases in either of these countries, he might decide that that's enough and he does not need to intervene.
Is there any possibility that Mohammed bin Salman could be arrested in Buenos Aires?
It's almost impossible, to be honest, because the time frame the judge needs to determine what he needs to know before moving forward will not allow him to do anything like that. If the case does move forward at any point, it will probably end up with an international request or warrant against bin Salman to be extradited to Argentina, which will probably mean not much. But in any case, it's a way of pointing out to these alleged crimes committed by the Crown Prince, both in Saudi Arabia, in other countries, and in Yemen, of course.
I know MBS has only been in Argentina for about 24 hours, but how has he been received so far?
I mean, the big news here has been this criminal case that seems to be starting in the Argentinian courts. That's the main headline in Argentina's newspaper related to MBS. Besides that, not much. MBS's entourage has also been very quiet. He's not been seen publicly that much. And it is said that he was going to stay in hotels in Buenos Aires. He had booked more than one hotel for him and the people coming with him. It was decided that it was safer that he stayed in the embassy. That was also reinforced in terms of security with stronger bulletproof glass and extra security surrounding the place.
So aside from Argentina being a signatory to this international treaty, why do you think it's Argentina the first in line to open up an investigation into MBS?
I think it was more about the NGO taking the opportunity of doing it here. And the fact that they got, if you wish, lucky and got a judge and a prosecutor that were willing to move forward. And also the Argentinian government that said, okay, this is an issue for the justice system and we are not related at all to that. Nevertheless, they've already been criticized for not lifting the diplomatic immunity on MBS, which means that even if the judge decides that he can move forward with some sort of detention or arrest, he won't be able to do it because of the diplomatic immunity.
And generally, Natalio, what else can we expect from the G20 summit with all these strongmen around Trump, Putin, Xi Jinping, Mohammed bin Salman?
Argentina has set up an agenda focused on very easy subjects. The future of work, for instance, infrastructure for development is another one. So we can expect there's going to be some agreement on that. The final product of this meeting will be a communique. And in the communique, the difficult topics will be international commerce and climate change. There will be others, but these ones will be key, together with migration, which are hot topics all around the world.
Reporter Natalio Cossoy speaking with us from Buenos Aires, where the G20 is getting underway. And if it's the G20, you know riot police are probably standing by with tear gas. Protests have become a common part of the G20 show, with hope no tear gas will fly in Buenos Aires like it did earlier this week at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's where U.S. border agents used tear gas against Central American migrants. Some of them were children. President Trump has said Border Patrol agents had to do it.
They had to use because they were being rushed by some very tough people, and they used tear gas. And here's the bottom line. Nobody's coming into our country unless they come in legally. Go ahead.
That was a high-profile incident. But the past decade has seen rising use of tear gas all around the world. And as Jen Kinney reports, this chemical often crosses borders as part of the growing trade in non-lethal weapons.
For me, the first time I ever had smelled tear gas was on the first day of the uprising on the 25th of January 2011.
Noor was 20 years old when the Egyptian uprising took hold in Cairo's Tahrir Square. He was out protesting every day for months. He'd been at political demonstrations before, but the number of people in the streets and the regular use of tear gas, that was new.
At the beginning, it was almost greeted with a curiosity. Will this gas really make you cry? And then a few seconds later, after you realize that I thought it was called tear gas. I had no idea it was called choke you to death and run around blindly gas.
Noor says he would try to pick up tear gas canisters that security forces lobbed at protesters and throw them away from the crowds.
Tear gas canisters, they kind of looked like soda cans from a distance. Silver, round. I remember seeing that some of the gas was made in the United Kingdom, some of the gas was made in Pennsylvania, if I remember correctly.
When we got tear gas, one time was really bad. They came and they wanted to evacuate the area.
Terry Burns lives on a small country road in Jamestown, Pennsylvania, population 617. Just a half mile behind her home, where she sells homegrown vegetables and lawn ornaments, is a munitions plant. Combined Systems Inc. manufactures and tests what are called non-lethal weapons, tear gas, smoke bombs, crowd control devices. She recalls one day there was an accident at the plant, and tear gas leaked onto her property.
It was a cloud, smoke coming our way. You could tell it was something so unusual. It's something dangerous, if that's what you want to say. I didn't know what to do.
Accidental tear gas releases like that one have been rare in Jamestown, but locals say you can hear test explosions multiple times a day.
It's just like anything else. People don't want it in their backyards. Is it better for our area? Yeah, probably brings in tax dollars and employment. I mean, you know, I wish it wasn't in our backyard. I wish it was in somebody else's backyard.
In a way, it already is. Combined Systems Inc. supplied Egypt with tear gas during the revolution, according to Amnesty International, which estimated that the company shipped some 46 tons of tear gas and other chemical irritants. So the gas Noor experienced, some of it probably came from Burns' backyard. Combined Systems Inc. didn't respond to requests for an interview for this story, but images circulated online of canisters in Cairo bearing CSI's brand name, its address in Jamestown, and the words "Made in the USA."
A pastime activity for some people during these clashes was to pick up these tear gas canisters and read who is the country that has supplied these weapons to try and kill us. So, look, this is American tear gas, or this is British tear gas. Oh no, they're cheap and they're using Chinese tear gas now. They want to kill us.
Non-lethal weapons are a multi-billion dollar a year business and growing. Combined Systems Inc. is one of the world's leading manufacturers, supplying not just Egypt, but also Israel, Bahrain, Ferguson, Missouri.
Almost everywhere that we see images of large-scale protests, we will also see somewhere on the street a Combined Systems Inc. product.
Anna Feigenbaum wrote a book on the history of tear gas. It was developed during World War I. Compared to other gases experimented with at the time, like sarin or mustard, tear gas was seen as less effective and less deadly.
When the war ended, there were all of these chemists and chemical companies that had been enlisted into the war effort. And there was this desire to continue these industries during peacetime. In the U.S., this was marketed as war gases for peacetime use.
Such as riot control. Tear gas doesn't just make your eyes water. It causes a burning sensation, difficulty breathing, chest pain, skin irritation. It can lead to nausea and vomiting, even convulsions. It's considered a chemical weapon. The 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention banned the use of tear gas in war, but many countries, including the U.S., still deploy it against domestic uprisings and unrest. Worldwide, the use of tear gas seems to be on the rise, though it can be difficult to get hard numbers.
The claim by the industry is that this industry is growing, that during 2011, where we had a lot mass kind of global protests, that sales in tear gas actually tripled, that we're continuing to see market growth, particularly in areas where there's kind of ongoing conflict.
That growth has been a boon for Jamestown. Combined Systems Inc. set up shop there in 1995.
My name is Mike Rowley. I'm Borough Council President for Jamestown, PA.
Until CSI opened up, there weren't many jobs in the area.
We used to have a lumber yard, two lumber yards at one time. There was probably 10 gas stations, two railroad stations in town, tracks going north and south, east and west. All that is gone. So now we have what we have, and there's not much here.
Today, there's some tourism-related businesses because of a nearby state park. There's a mill that makes paint. And then there's CSI, which employs around 230 people.
Something like that was pretty much a godsend for a lot of people. There just isn't, in this immediate area, there's just not the work that there used to be.
Riley says CSI is good for the community, and he says it's important work.
There's a lot of times when they say, like in Israel, when they use their non-lethal bullets and their rubber bullets and their gas and that, so most of the time it comes from here. Oh, yeah, and most of the people say, yep, we manufactured that. We put that together. We sent it. There's a little bit of pride involved in that. It's non-lethal, that's even better.
Tear gas has been a godsend in the sense that it's truly non-lethal. It's very, very difficult to accidentally kill somebody. It would almost have to be done intentionally.
Sid Heal has served over 30 years in the Marine Reserves and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. He's made it his life's mission to increase non-lethal options for law enforcement and military. And he's helped develop some, like a heat ray that makes a person feel like they've been scalded with hot water. Tear gas isn't his favorite option.
I don't like it. It's got all kinds of problems. It's not an ideal. It's just better than the alternative. One of the things people forget is the fact that the standard is not perfection. The standard is the alternative. And in many cases, the alternative is lethal force.
But protesters have died from tear gas in Egypt, in Bahrain, in Gaza. Some died from asphyxiation when gas was fired in too concentrated a dose in too small a space. And some from the canisters themselves. Noor himself spent days in the hospital after being struck by a canister just above his left eye.
Sometimes the tear gas was actually being fired head on to get people in the head. To get people in the groin. This was a common practice.
Heal says that's a result of using the weapon incorrectly. But Feigenbaum, who wrote the book on tear gas, rejects that.
To say that something which was designed to cause sensory torture and inflict pain that we know has caused a lot of death and that its actual real-world use very much reveals it to be something that can easily be lethal. And even this idea of less lethality, you know, I always say, you know, well, explain to me what a less lethal death is. You know, what does that mean, to die in a less lethal way?
Governments don't track deaths by tear gas, so there's no way of knowing how many people have died from it. In Cairo, hundreds died in other ways, killed by security forces. The uprising ended, the gas dissipated. But even now, Noor says he has conflicted memories of that time.
What I'm about to describe now might sound a bit masochistic, but after a while, sometimes you miss the gas.
Back during the uprising, he took home a canister, sealed it in a bag, and every once in a while he would take the bag out
and take one or two sniffs from inside the bag just to get the scent of the tear gas into my nose. Life is actually about encountering death regularly.
And he says the smell of tear gas was an instant reminder of that. For the world, I'm Jen Kinney.
A version of that story aired on WESA in Pittsburgh. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. In the studio with me is Brandy Fullwood. You might recognize Brandy as one of our newsroom's music boffins. Hey, Brandy.
But that's not why I'm here today, Marco.
No?
It's sort of why I'm here, but not exactly.
All right. Why are you here?
I'm here to give you a quiz. And that's our game show quiz music. I found it on YouTube.
Excellent. I love quizzes. You know, not always fast at them. I usually spend a week on the Sunday crossword. But hit me. What's this quiz about?
This quiz is going to be about UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. And it comes out every year, but the new one came out today. So are you ready?
Yeah, I am ready. Especially what I heard was on this list from UNESCO today. So what do you got?
Are you writing down answers?
No.
Sure. What does intangible mean?
That's the first question. What does intangible mean? Intangible is something that we know exists, but we can't really see it, you know, like love or sunshine or the aroma of French fries from the deli across the street.
Well, in this context, it's more about oral traditions or performing arts like music or song, puppetry and theater, and then also social practices, so things that are kind of like rituals and festivals, just basically things that people practice on a day-to-day basis that aren't tangible objects of their culture. So nothing like a monument or a painting.
Gotcha. So why, Brandy, did the UN establish this list of intangible cultural heritage in the first place?
Marco, I'm giving the quiz.
Oh, right. I forgot. Okay. Can you answer that, though?
Yeah. So the answer is it gets recognition and it gets media coverage. Voila. And the other thing that happens is that countries who apply to this, they commit to safeguarding their intangible object in ways that are like putting them into museums or adopting them into schools and so on and so forth. So are you ready for the rest of the quiz?
Yeah, I think I did pretty well on the intangible question. Yeah, what else is there?
I think you're just stalling. So there's this instrument in Serbia, and they use it to perform songs predominantly about mythical and historical heroes. I'm going to play it, and then you should guess what that instrument is. But I want to put out that the full performance is the intangible object.
Gotcha.
But you're going to guess the tangible one.
All right. I associate trumpet music with Serbia. Clearly, that's not a trumpet. It sounds like a stringed instrument. Could be a violin, but I play a violin, and that only has one, maybe two strings, this thing. So I don't know what it is. What is it?
You play violin?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's pretty close. It's a simple string instrument, and it's called gusle. It's been used for centuries in these ancient art performances, primarily about heroic epics. They're really dramatic, and they involve a lot of body language and charisma, pretty much to tell the stories about mythic heroes.
So gusle, that is on Serbia's list of intangible cultural heritage. All right, what else do you have in this quiz?
Well, I'm going to play this clip first of people playing tamboradas.
Okay, tamboradas, percussion instrument.
Yes, but where is it from?
I'm going to guess Brazil. That sounded like the Brazilian bateria.
A couple miles off, it's Spain. This
You're being very kind a couple of miles off.
This instrument, or this performance, rather, is really loud, as you've heard. It's an intense beating of thousands of drums, and it happens for days and nights. And maybe you've seen it before. It's part of the Catholic Holy Week celebrations.
So this is now part of Spain's intangible cultural heritage. Congratulations to Spain.
And then a non-music question. How fast can a camel run?
Oh, my gosh. And this is still intangible cultural heritage year. Can I get multiple choice on this, Brandy?
Sure. A, 20 miles an hour. B, 40 miles an hour. Or C, 65 miles an hour.
I feel like I've seen camels running before. I'm going to say 20 seems a little slow, but actually, I'm going to say 20 miles an hour.
It's B, 40 miles an hour.
I was almost going to say B. Anyway, I wasn't almost going to say B.
I'm asking about camels because Arda, it's from Oman, and it's also on the list. It's this really cool festival that involves horses and camel riders.
Arda in Oman. So that's their hit today from UNESCO. Very good stuff. And we've got time for one more quiz question.
And last but certainly not least, this one is a dead giveaway. It's reggae. Reggae made it onto the list from Jamaica because it originates from Kingston. And as a lot of reggae fans know already, it started out with a ton of musical influences, but primarily transformed from two precursors. What are they?
Two precursors to reggae. Mento and ska.
So close. I feel like I could give you partial credit for that. So it's ska and it's rock steady. Ska comes first, and ska has the mento
Who
influences.
Said that? UNESCO? Because I'll take up a debate with UNESCO on that one. They can have it today, but
we'll have to call them up, but I guess we should just maybe play some reggae to give you credit for your half point.
Oh, come on. 2 points, please?
I'll give you 1.5.
The world's Brandy Fullwood, thanks very much for this. I can't wait till the next quiz. I hope I passed.
Thanks, Marco.
Sun is shining, the weather is sweet, yeah. Make you wanna move your dancing feet.
Sun Is Shining, a Bob Marley classic, mixed down by his legendary producer Lee Scratch Perry, all feeling extremely tangible at the moment. There are more than 300 intangible cultural treasures on that UNESCO list from countries all over the globe, but not from the U.S. Global politics, enough said. So here's a question for you. What intangible American cultural things would you add to the list? You know, if that were possible, think the blues or maybe breakdancing. Go to Instagram and our Twitter accounts and let us know. We are at PRI The World. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Sun is shining, the weather is sweet now. Make you wanna move your dancing feet, yeah. But to the rescue, here I am. Want you to know just if you can, here I stand. No, 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 no.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the philanthropic foundation Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security at carnegie.org. PRI 2020 donors, including Cecilia and Garrett Boone, John and Caroline Ballantyne, and Betsy Atwater, in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly. The Skoll Foundation, partnering with social entrepreneurs and other innovators to confront the world's most pressing problems at home and abroad. Learn more at skoll.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.